presidency for 30 years, finally defeated in May 2009. But it was not religious, it was more ethnic. Hmm.
So that leads us to the current moment. I mean, as we think about the broader context of these attacks that happened on Sunday, Easter Sunday, what is the political and social situation in Sri Lanka like today?
Well, I mean, there's been an effort to promote reconciliation, reform, accountability in the aftermath of the end of that civil war. The end of that civil war had a lot of basic human rights war crimes to end the war, but it did end the war. And so there's been a 10-year attempt to try to do reconciliation, economic development, et cetera. And there's been some progress, incomplete homework, I would say, but some progress. And there's been increase in tourism. There's been some economic development. I think all of this will certainly be affected by what is a massive attack that took place on Easter Sunday, and it certainly will eventually play into the politics as in Sri Lanka. Right now, of course, the government has tried to come together in a unified way to look at what happened, to see how to react, but eventually there will be political and economic ramifications, I would guess.
I want to get to those in a moment, but I do want to ask about the tactics of response here. The government in Sri Lanka is blocking major social media and messaging services in the country. What does that tell you?
Well, I think that's a very mixed picture, because obviously it's hard to get the truth out if you're blocking the vehicles by which people use to communicate between families and loved ones and more broadly. But this is a direct reaction to what happened a year ago when the Muslim community in the central city of Kandy was attacked by extremist Buddhist mobs who incited their followers to go out using social media. So there's sort of a bad history in Sri Lanka of using Facebook, etc., to spread false information and incite violence. So I think that explains the government's reason behind stopping the use of social media, but obviously it's a very mixed bag.
So you alluded to political ramifications. Just when it comes to the situation today, I mean, the prime minister has acknowledged that there may have been some intelligence missteps, that the, quote, information was there when it came to warnings about potential attacks like this, but that he was never personally informed. Does that reflect a deeper rift within the Sri Lankan government?
Well, there's a very uneasy relationship between the president of the country, President Sirisena, and the Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe. In fact, in October, the president tried to replace the prime minister with the person the president had defeated in office back in 2015, and he failed constitutionally, judicially, politically to replace the prime minister. But it's clear there's an uneasy relationship between the president and the prime minister. But I would expect that there would be an attempt to unify the response to this horrible, horrible attack. The issue, though, is that there are presidential elections that must take place constitutionally by the end of the year. And will this become an issue by which the former president, Mahinda Rajapaksa, who was defeated in 2015, tries to promote his party's fortunes by saying he defeated terrorism in 2009 when he exterminated the Tamil Tigers, and now he can protect Sri Lanka again? So I expect this will play out politically inside Sri Lanka over the next few months, even if right now the immediate issue is the aftermath, the investigation, security.
Right, and lives lost and grieving those lives. Jeffrey Feltman, former Undersecretary General for Political Affairs at the United Nations, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Here in the United States, the devastating floods in the Midwest last month caused billions of dollars in damage, and those losses are still mounting. As Frank Morris from member station KCUR reports, the final tally of those losses will likely include entire communities torn apart by this disaster.
Lynch, Nebraska, with just 200 residents, is tucked away on the South Dakota line. It seems like a remarkably successful town.
To have, like, hospital, you know, theater, it's all run by volunteers, and then we got the bowling alley here.
Kevin Thompson is the local electrician.
We got a couple bars, and we got a face barbecue down the street.
But this town's in trouble. The grocery store is for sale. Employee Georgia Courtney is worried about losing her job and finding a place to live.
Well, I'm homeless right now, but I'm staying with friends. There's a lot of us displaced that are trying to find a place to go, a place to live, or whatever, but there's not that much housing in this town.
Not since last month's flood, when Ponca Creek, running through Lynch, jumped its banks, swamping about a third of the town, setting off a chain reaction that threatens to unravel this tight-knit community.
Everybody would really like to stay here, but we don't have the housing. I mean, there's just not enough room.
Tamara Smith lost her home. She's disabled and worries that the tiny hospital here will soon close, so she's moving.
It's a rough time for everybody, and it's going to get a lot rougher.
The flood hit the only sector bringing money into this area, agriculture. Ranchers lost cattle, hay to feed them, and in some cases, access to pastures. Diane Heiser says she and her husband may sell out and leave.
It's tough, and we live really in paradise. I mean, this is gorgeous. This valley here is absolutely beautiful. But the economics are just, and they're not getting any easier. It just gets harder and harder and harder to make it.
And it's not just Lynch. Last month's flood is forcing a reckoning in ravaged towns and farms across parts of four states.
Well, I don't think most of the people in Bartlett will come back.
Farmer Pat Sheldon is talking about Bartlett, Iowa, population 50, on the southwest edge of the state flooded by the Missouri River.
I don't think there's hardly anybody in McPaul that will come back. I mean, they've had water up to their eaves or higher. The town that I grew up in around Percival, we might be lucky if half the residents come back.
Well, I guess I'll take a hot dog.
Okay.
In Glenwood, Iowa, volunteers are serving lunch to flood victims from little towns nearby here.
My name's Sharon Stewart, and I'm from Pacific Junction, Iowa.
An old railroad town, close to the Missouri River and prone to flooding. But Stewart says the crests never reached her house until last month when it took 12 feet of water. She says many of Pacific Junction's 450 people are, like her, lifelong residents who won't be going home.
They can't go back and face this again, knowing that everything they had is gone. It's kind of like a death.
Want to drive down the road, down that way.
Farther downstream, Richard Oswald farms near Rockport, Missouri, but he's not farming today.
Well, I've heard people say, well, I guess it's going to be a summer off because if you can see all the water on the fields around us and these fields over here to your right, those are fields that I farm, and they're completely covered with water. There's still 5 feet of water on that field.
The deluge broke records here and came up neck deep in a place where Oswald had never, in his 69 years, seen flooding before. The house where he was born and where he's lived most of his life.
Well, I'm not going to go back to that house, and I'm not going to let anybody else live in that house because I don't think it's going to be safe.
He's concerned about mold and future floods amplified by climate change and river management. There's also the threat of aging dams upstream from here giving way. But with all that hanging over his operation, Oswald is just not ready to give up farming this land.
I've even had people that I was and that I am friendly with who, when this occurred, said, well, it's just time to let this all go back to nature down here. Well, that's my farm.
It's clear that last month's flood is straining, sometimes breaking, tight bonds between farmers and their land and between small-town residents and their lifelong communities. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.
And let's look ahead to All Things Considered later this afternoon. We're delving into a new NPR Ipsos poll on climate change. You're going to hear from teachers in Alaska about an innovative way they've been teaching the subject, with parts of the state warming twice as fast as the rest of the world. You can hear that story on your radio or ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your local member station. This is NPR News.
Good morning, and thanks for joining us for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. On the program in just a bit, the votes are still being counted in Ukraine, but it appears that a comedian with no political experience will be the country's next president. So far, the sitcom actor has about 75% of the vote. We'll have the story of the Ukrainian election coming up in about 20 minutes here on WPR.
In 2017, U.S. Navy destroyers collided with large commercial ships in two separate incidents in the South China Sea, killing 17 American sailors. On the next Fresh Air, we speak with ProPublica's T. Christian Miller. part of an investigative team that found chronic understaffing and other problems affecting ships in the Seventh Fleet, which responds to threats from China, North Korea, and Russia. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this evening at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Glass Nickel Pizza. 21 years of employee and customer-inspired pizzas made from scratch at 8 Wisconsin locations. Dedicated to sustainability practices and community support. Glass Nickel Pizza.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Softwave Fish Company. Sourced from around the globe, Softwave currently offers salmon, shrimp, Alaskan king crab legs, and more. The market is open Saturdays and the roadie from 10 until 2.
In WPR weather, a flood watch is in effect for northern and east central Wisconsin through tomorrow morning, plus there are a number of local flood warnings. Rain and thunderstorms in the northern half of the state today, in the south partly sunny until some rain late in the day. Gusty winds and highs ranging from the 40s in the north to the 70s in the south.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Tire Rack, family-owned and operated for 40 years. Since 1979, Tire Rack has been committed to helping people find the right tires, wheels, and other performance parts. More at TireRack.com. From C3, C3's AI software suite enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale to solve previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at c3.ai. And from the University at Buffalo, where researchers are detecting cancer with a smartphone, where collaboration provides the inspiration and determination drives every discovery. More at buffalo.edu/NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green. The world's biggest democracy, India, is holding elections right now. Voting actually began earlier this month, and it lasts for 5 weeks. During these elections, we're looking at a big trend in India. As its economy has opened to the world and grown really robustly, so has Hindu pride. Some call it Hindu nationalism. A lifetime after India cast off colonial rule, it is embracing a new identity, and its majority Hindu faith is a big part of that. NPR's India correspondent Lauren Freyer joins us now to talk about this theme and also tell us about the stories she's going to be bringing us in the coming days. Hi, Lauren.
Hi there.
So can I start with a really basic question? What is Hindu nationalism?
Sure. So Hinduism is the biggest religion in India, polytheistic. That means that there are many gods. And it's historically been open to embracing of diversity of traditions. About 80% of Indians are Hindus. Now, Hindu nationalism is political. It's the idea that the Hindu faith and culture should shape the state and its policies. And the movement has its roots in the 19th century in opposition to liberal Hindu reformers, colonialism, and Christian missionaries.
Okay, so this is something that started in opposition to something else a long time ago. Why is it on your mind now? Why are we thinking about it?
Because Prime Minister Narendra Modi is a Hindu nationalist. He belongs to a Hindu nationalist political party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, and he spent his formative years working for this group called the RSS. Some members call it like a Hindu version of the Boy Scouts, focusing on values and civic life. But, you know, they also train with weapons and have participated in anti-Muslim riots. Modi is running for a second term, and many see this election as a real turning point for India. Milan Vaishnav, who directs the South Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment in Washington, D.C., says this election will determine
India's future as a secular republic that embraces pluralism and, you know, kind of adheres to the founders' notion that India's unity is strengthened by its diversity. And over the past 5 years, we have seen the rise of a Hindu nationalist party and the spread of this kind of nationalist ideology.
And that ideology is often at odds with the secularism that is enshrined in India's constitution, the whole system that India has really had since independence from Britain in 1947.
Huh, so this is really quite a moment in this country. I mean, it's been secular for, I'm just doing the math, for like 70 or so years. Where is this drive to change that coming from?
Right, so let's go back to India's founding. 1947, freedom from the British, India decided to become secular, and here's why. India is so diverse. I mean, there are hundreds of languages, ethnic groups, castes. And the founding fathers, among them Mahatma Gandhi and Jawaharlal Nehru, believed that really only a pluralist democracy could hold such diversity together. Hindu nationalists, though, were really miffed. They wanted a Hindu state, and they didn't get it. And it was actually a Hindu nationalist who, less than a year later, assassinated Gandhi. And so Gandhi's death sort of shut down this whole debate, and secularism took hold. And now, a lifetime later, the debate is opening up. India elected a Hindu nationalist prime minister, Modi. Right now, like, even secular parties are scrambling to brandish their Hindu nationalist cred because it's just so popular with voters.
Okay, you have a prime minister who's a Hindu nationalist. I mean, Hindu nationalism is now mainstream. This party's been in power for 5 years. How has India as a country, as a culture, changed?
Beef bans, for example, cows are sacred to Hindus. I can get a hamburger in my Mumbai neighborhood, but it's buffalo meat. Ayurveda is all the rage. That's food, health, and beauty products based on ancient Hindu healing traditions. You know, in the U.S., you've got this wellness craze, Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop. Well, yeah. Here, it's a Hindu wellness industry, and it's absolutely booming. The very map of India is changing. Cities and landmarks with Muslim-sounding names, Allahabad, for example, a city in northern India built by Muslim kings in the 16th century, they've changed its name to Prayagraj, a word that refers to a Hindu holy site there. I went to that city and I spoke with Yogeshwar Tiwari. He's the head of the local university history department. And he calls those Muslim kings invaders who forcibly converted Hindus. And he says now history has to be revised.
People now certainly feel history has not been presented and narrated and understood in the way that it should have been understood. Every nation goes through course correction.
And that makes Indian Muslims pretty uncomfortable. I mean, this is their heritage. One in six Indians is Muslim. They're a bigger minority than African Americans are in the U.S. We're talking about 180 million people here.
So if India moves farther and farther away from the secular past and Hindu identity really takes hold even more, what does that look like? What are the implications?
So some say India could become a Hindu homeland in the way Israel is a homeland for Jews worldwide. In fact, Modi's government has introduced a new citizenship amendment bill that would give Indian citizenship to anybody persecuted in neighboring countries, except if they're Muslim. So India would be using religion as a criteria for citizenship for the first time. Another possible model is Turkey, a secular republic that's seen its majority Muslim faith brought into public life in a more overt way under Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Well, so you're covering an election right now, and this whole conversation seems very central. I mean, it's really a debate about getting to the heart of who India wants to be, and a lot will ride on whether Prime Minister Modi wins this or not. What do you think? What are the polls suggesting?
So most observers say he will win, and the question is by how much, and that would really determine his mandate to change the country. But it's not just Modi. Tanika Sarkar is a historian retired from Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi. And she says Hindu nationalists have grown these really deep roots into Indian society.
They have associations among students, trade unions, retired army people, religion, of course, temples. They have penetrated the everyday lives of Hindus in a very big way. Whether they win the election or lose the election, this work will go on.
India is still a young country, 72 years old. It's still really working out who it wants to be. And increasingly, Hindu nationalism is going to be a part of the answer to that.
Such interesting stuff. Well, you have me interested in this election very much now. I can't wait to follow your stories as you bring them to us later this week.
Thanks so much, David.
Thank you. That's NPR's Lauren Frayer speaking to us this morning from Mumbai. This is NPR News.
Google and its sister companies are working hard to move artificial intelligence out of our smartphones and web browsers and into the world of medicine.
Patients are already seeing this intersection between technology and healthcare. It's just we're hitting an inflection point.
What will happen when one of the world's biggest companies steps into this personal space? This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Brady Carlson is your host for All Things Considered. It starts at 4 here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News and Classical Music.
Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. News from NPR is next, and in the WPR newscast, we'll hear about new efforts in Dodgeville to fight the opioid crisis, which has hit rural Wisconsin particularly hard. Details on the way.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Armed security personnel can be seen on the streets of Sri Lanka's capital today following Easter Sunday bombings that killed 290 people. Hundreds more were wounded. Suicide bombers targeted churches and hotels in Colombo. Police say each bomber was a Sri Lankan who belonged to a domestic militant group. Several Americans are among the dead. NPR's Lauren Frayer has more.
Most were local Sri Lankans, many of them Catholics, attending Easter Mass. Funerals are now underway, including one today for the 13-year-old daughter of a Muslim man and his Catholic wife. The foreigners killed include three of the four children of a Danish tycoon who were on vacation. More than 500 people were wounded. Tuesday has been declared a national day of mourning.
Prosecutors in Japan are filing new charges against former Nissan chairman Carlos Ghosn. This is the fourth time Ghosn's been charged in recent months. NPR's Anthony Kuhn says Ghosn denies all accusations against him, including financial misconduct.
Ghosn was detained on financial misconduct charges in November, and his detention would have ended today if prosecutors hadn't brought fresh charges. This time, he's accused of skimming money from a Nissan subsidiary and using it to buy jets and a yacht. Before his fall, Ghosn led a mighty automotive alliance, including Nissan, Mitsubishi, and France's Renault.
This is NPR News from Washington.
This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. A home for women recovering from opioid addiction will open in Dodgeville next month. It's the first of four houses Southwestern Wisconsin Community Action Program hopes to open in rural Wisconsin. Kimberly Hill is coordinating the project. She says recovery houses are all about building community and accountability for recovering addicts.
They work because you need community. You need connection. That's just the way we're made as humans.
Residents will pay about $400 a month for rent and services, including peer counseling. They'll be required to attend three recovery meetings a week and volunteer or work. Coordinators say applicants must no longer be using drugs in order to be eligible for the program. An investigation has found that as many as 10 students and staff reported that they were sexually harassed by the husband of former University of Wisconsin-Whitewater Chancellor Beverly Copper. Copper resigned in December after her husband, Alan Pete Hill, was banned from campus. The university released its 18-page investigative report and about 850 pages of attachments on Friday in response to an Associated Press open records request. UW spokesman Mark Pitch said in a statement that President Ray Cross advised Copper to resign after he was briefed on findings of the report in mid-December. Pitch says, quote, "The report speaks for itself." The investigation found no evidence that Copper knew about or facilitated the actions of her husband, even though his behavior was, quote, "pervasive and well-known." A British cybersecurity researcher credited with stopping a worldwide computer virus in 2017 has pleaded guilty to developing malware to steal banking information. Federal prosecutors in Wisconsin and Marcus Hutchins' attorneys said in a filing Friday that the 24-year-old is pleading guilty to developing the malware and conspiring to distribute it from 2012 to 2015. In exchange for his plea to those charges, prosecutors are dismissing eight more. Hutchins said in a statement that he regrets his actions and takes, quote, "full responsibility for his mistakes." Hutchins' arrest on August 2, 2017 came just months after he was praised for finding a kill switch to the WannaCry virus that crippled computers worldwide.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru. Introducing the all-new 2019 Subaru Forester, featuring standard symmetrical all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com. And from the financial services firm of Raymond James, offering personalized wealth management advice and banking and capital markets expertise, along with a legacy of putting clients' financial well-being first. Learn more at RaymondJames.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm David Green in Culver City, California. Good morning. So first there was the waiting for the Mueller report, then the release of the redacted Mueller report, and now we have the fallout from the Mueller report. And this fallout includes a lot of different interpretations. Democrats now have even more questions, a lot of questions. The White House is really looking to have it both ways. They're claiming the Mueller report was rigged. They're also insisting that it exonerates Donald Trump, even though the report says the opposite.
They tried very, very hard to create a case that the president was involved in Russian whatever. Couldn't do it.
The Mueller report itself says that there was no interference. No,
there's nothing wrong with taking information from Russians.
The president is not going to jail. He's staying in the White House for 5.5 more years.
All right, we heard there the president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, also senior White House counselor Kellyanne Conway on Fox News Sunday, ABC's This Week, and CNN's State of the Union. I'm joined by NPR White House correspondent and host of the NPR Politics podcast, Tamara Keith. Hi, Tam.
Hi.
So the president's team, I mean, is this a love-hate relationship with the Mueller report? What are they saying here?
Yeah, I think that they are looking at a couple of different things. They are both talking about legally the president was not indicted on anything. So they're saying, look, clean bill of health on the law. Mueller did not find anything that was prosecutable. And then they're also saying, but hey, this report has a lot of stuff in it that is negative and could be embarrassing to the president, like a bunch of his subordinates not doing what he told them to do. And so the report, they say, is rigged, or various other terms. The president used a term that we can't repeat on the radio to describe the report.
So they're basically saying, I mean, the law is what's important. Ignore the morality and ethics and other things that may have come up with this behavior.
Quite literally, Rudy Giuliani on CNN said, morality, that isn't what prosecutors look at. They're very much focused on the law. Democrats, on the other hand, are going to be focused as they continue to hold hearings and do the investigations that they've already started. They're going to be looking at things about, like, what is right and wrong, what example to set, whether there was abuse of power, and other things that aren't illegal, but may be questionable.
And they have, House Democrats have what sounds like a pretty important conference call, maybe to talk about strategy this morning. What are they thinking about?
Well, they are considering how to proceed. Several top Democrats have said in the last several days since the Mueller report came out, hey, there's a lot of stuff in here that we're very concerned about. We don't want to set a precedent that it's okay for a president to, for a campaign to accept help from a foreign adversary, or for a president to want to shut down investigations and order people to shut down an investigation. But on the other hand, they're saying impeachment would be the course, but how do you proceed on impeachment? That's their concern, because they say the Senate certainly wouldn't convict. So is it a political folly to move in that direction?
Although some Democrats saying it's worth it no matter what the Senate would do. I mean, because the important role that they feel they play, which really speaks to the moment for Democrats in terms of what to do next. Is this a good campaign issue? I mean, are they talking about it on the campaign trail?
They aren't talking about it much on the campaign trail. Elizabeth Warren did bring it up, said that she thought that they should move to impeachment, but many other candidates are keeping their distance, in part, they say, because they aren't hearing a lot from voters about demands for impeachment.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Tam, thanks.
You're welcome.
Art is imitating life in Ukraine. Almost all the votes have been counted in the presidential election there, and the winner is a comedian who plays a president on television.
Ми зробили це разом.
And that is the voice of Volodymyr. I'll get it out. Volodymyr Zelensky. He was greeting supporters Sunday night after his landslide victory. He made a name for himself in a TV show called Servant of the People, in which he plays a high school teacher who becomes Ukraine's president by a twist of fate. And Pierre's Lucien Kim has been covering the election, and we've got him on the line from Moscow. Hi, Lucien.
Good morning.
So Zelensky has no political experience, unless you count playing a president on TV as experience. Clearly, Ukrainians were willing to take a risk here. Why?
practically everybody in Ukraine knows Volodymyr Zelensky, thanks to his various TV shows, and especially that show Servant of the People, where he plays this honest, incorruptible guy who ends up being president. What's amazing is that despite Zelensky being a household name, people don't really know what he stands for. And during the election campaign, he was very vague about his positions. And in that way, he really became a blank slate for people to project whatever they wanted on him. Hmm. Ukrainians expected real change from the incumbent Petro Poroshenko, whom they elected 5 years ago. They wanted a resolution to a Russian-backed insurgency in eastern Ukraine. They wanted an end to corruption and a turnaround in the economy. And I think the fact that they chose Zelensky shows how desperate people are. But at the same time, I think it's worth noting that this was a victory for democracy in Ukraine. Poroshenko almost immediately conceded defeat, and now there will be a peaceful transfer of power.
Right. So that is significant. But what about Ukraine's conflict with Russia? It's been going on for years now. I mean, what will Zelensky's victory mean for that?
Well, this is the big question, and maybe even the biggest question. Poroshenko, the incumbent, had tried to portray himself as the only candidate who could stand up to Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. This is what Poroshenko said after conceding on Sunday night.
You may just look at the celebration in the Kremlin of the occasion of the election. They believe that with a new, inexperienced Ukrainian president, Ukraine could be quickly returned to the Russia orbit of influence.
So there's been a real personal animosity between Poroshenko and Putin in recent months, and Putin pretty much made clear that he didn't want to deal with Poroshenko anymore. So now with Zelensky's victory, there may in fact be an opening. I think by voting for Zelensky, Ukrainians show that they're really tired by this low-level war with Russia.
Hmm. What about Ukraine's relationship with the U.S.? I mean, Poroshenko was a close ally. Does Zelensky see the United States in the same way?
Well, Poroshenko certainly made a lot of his relationship to the U.S., and as we just heard, he portrayed Zelensky as someone who could be easily manipulated by the Kremlin. So it remains to be seen how Zelensky will develop his relations with the U.S. We're hearing that President Trump has already congratulated Zelensky and said that the U.S. would continue to support Ukraine. But Ukraine's big problem has always been that it's never really been front and center in U.S. foreign policy. Zelensky may actually have a chance to meet President Trump at the beginning of June. They're both expected to be at the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landings in Normandy, France.
All right. NPR's Lucien Kim for us from Moscow. Lucien, thanks. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Rachel.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:42 right now, and thanks for joining us here on WPR. Coming up on Morning Edition, most of us have a type, certain qualities that we're just more into in another person. Culture influences those sexual attractions, but can we change them if we want to?
You know, establishing these rules and thinking that, you know, you figured it out, it's like, then life happens.
Coming up, a bit of a grown-up story about the science of desire. That's in 9 minutes.
WPR Travel heads to classic Italy September 14th through September 22nd, featuring Rome, Florence, and Venice. This is Zorba Pastor, and I'll be hosting this holiday vacations trip. Our time in Florence includes a visit to the Galleria dell'Accademia, home of Michelangelo's famous David statue. We'll also explore the museums and enjoy the fresh gelato of Italy. Details and links can be found at wpr.org/travel.
Support for WPR comes from Reynolds Transfer and Storage, dedicated to providing quality household moving and storage services throughout Wisconsin and North America. More information, including move estimates, is at ReynoldsTransfer.com.
Support comes from Carthage College, welcoming author Peter Annan for the first lecture in the Gunderson Lecture Series. On April 24th at 7 p.m., Mr. Annan will give a talk titled Great Lakes Water Tension in the 21st Century. Details at carthage.edu/Gunderson.
8:44 now, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Here are some of the day's major stories. Sri Lankan officials had a dramatic reaction after the Easter attacks on churches and hotels killed hundreds. The government turned off most social media. The block on sites and apps, including Facebook and its WhatsApp and Instagram services, were announced by state media, which cited the spread of, quote, false news reports online. President Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani is defending the Trump campaign and its contacts with Russians. Giuliani says there wasn't anything wrong with the Trump campaign taking information from those connected with the Russian government. Giuliani is referring to the 2016 Trump Tower meeting involving Donald Trump Jr. and others in which they sought information damaging to Hillary Clinton.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Zoom. Zoom offers cloud video conferencing, online meetings, and a video conference room solution in one platform, featuring digital video and audio with screen sharing, account registration, and more at zoom.us. And from Indeed, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where employers can post jobs and use screener questions to build their short list of preferred candidates. Learn more at indeed.com/hire.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green. The State Department this morning is threatening to punish its allies to get at Iran. The United States is trying to get other countries to stop buying Iranian oil.
Today I'm announcing that we will no longer grant any exemptions. We're going to zero. Going to zero across the board.
That's the voice of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announcing an end to waivers it had granted to countries like Japan and Turkey. This is all part of an effort the United States began a year ago when it pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. That was the international agreement giving Iran sanctions relief in exchange for limits on its nuclear program. Let's talk this through with NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, who's at the State Department. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, good morning.
So explain exactly what Pompeo is doing here.
So he came in to discuss this next phase of the pressure campaign, you might say. As you mentioned, the administration pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal a year ago, and it's been reimposing sanctions that were suspended under that deal. And that includes what we call secondary sanctions, that is, sanctions on countries that import oil from Iran. The U.S. gave seven countries and Taiwan a waiver for 6 months the last time, but that period is now coming to an end. The administration says it won't extend those waivers any further. They say the oil market is well supplied now, so they argue that this is a good time to push countries to get to zero, to stop importing Iranian oil completely.
So is it just that it's a good time, or do they feel like taking away these waivers could really, you know, hurt the Iranian economy even more?
Well, that's the big part. I mean, oil is the number one source of cash for Iran's economy. Pompeo says that they've so far denied Iran, he claims, more than $10 billion in oil revenue. But the Trump administration faced some criticism from the right for giving too many waivers the last time around. So now they're cracking down harder. It's not clear what they're contemplating as far as punishments are concerned if these countries do continue to buy oil from Iran. Pompeo says the risks aren't worth the benefits, but his aides really wouldn't say if, you know, these are going to be targeted sanctions or if they're going to go for sanctions that are really going to affect trade relations with these countries. And remember, David, we're talking about countries like China, India, and Turkey.
Well, can we talk about one of the complexities with the nuclear deal that you and I have spoken about? I mean, when the United States pulled out, other countries did not. And there were all these questions about what the United States could or couldn't do to change other countries' behaviors. Is that part of the context here?
Yeah, I mean, proponents of the deal say that it's working, that Iran is abiding by it. It's limiting Iran's nuclear program. Pompeo downplays that, though. He talks about an enormous coalition which is countering Iran now. He talks about the Gulf states and Israel and some Europeans. But, you know, as you mentioned, there were other world powers that are invested in this. Russia, China, UK, France, and Germany all helped negotiate the deal. The Trump administration always argued that the deal was too weak, and it also didn't cover all these other problems with Iran. Iran's support for militias throughout the region, its ballistic missile programs, and they're trying to really push on that.
And as they push on things like this, the ultimate goal of the Trump administration is still, what, regime change in Tehran?
Well, they say it's about changing the behavior of Iran. But, of course, there's a lot of questions about how you do that. And it's hard right now to see a pathway for diplomacy on this, a way to get back to some sort of deal, either the Iran nuclear deal or something broader.
NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman at the State Department this morning. Michelle, thanks as always.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 10 minutes before 9, and classical music with Stephanie Elkins is coming up after news from NPR and WPR in about 17 minutes. Music of Haydn starts the program, and Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini is also in the 9 o'clock hour. And some lute music by John Dowland starts the 10 o'clock hour. All that and much more coming.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea. For over 100 years, they've been celebrating spring with the finest in Easter treats, from their famous pectin jelly beans to solid milk and dark chocolate bunnies. They'll help you assemble the perfect Easter basket for your loved ones. 2401 60th Street, Kenosha.
Workplay Earth Day volunteer events are great for adults and for kids, too. Find out where and when Workplay Earth Days are happening in your area at WPR.org/events.
Thanks for listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now it's 8:50. And in sports, in the first round of the NBA playoffs, the Bucks beat the Pistons over the weekend to take a 3-0 lead in the series. Game 4 is tonight at 7 o'clock. The Milwaukee Brewers lost to the Dodgers last night 6-5, giving L.A. the series. The Brewers will be in St. Louis today to start a 3-game series against the Cardinals. A flood watch is in effect for northern and east central Wisconsin through tomorrow morning, plus there are many local flood warnings in the state. We're expecting rain and thunderstorms in the northern part of Wisconsin, in the south partly sunny until some rain late in the day, gusty winds and highs ranging from the 40s in the north to the 70s in the south.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Rachel Martin. The fifth season of NPR's podcast Invisibilia just wrapped. And in it, the team dove deep into the science of desire with a story of one young woman who diagnosed a problem with her own sexual attractions, a problem not too many people would be willing to talk about publicly. We are using the first initial of this woman's name to protect her privacy. Also, a warning, this story may not be suitable for younger listeners. Here's NPR's Yowei Sha.
It was 2013. Elle was a sophomore in college, procrastinating yet again on Reddit, when she happened upon a thread about sexual attraction. One of the posters was asking people what races they were most sexually attracted to. And Elle was like, interesting question. And she posted,
I'm mostly attracted to white and Asian guys, but, you know, I'd like to be open-minded.
Elle thought nothing of it until someone replied to her comment.
Oh, so you won't date brown guys or black guys? I was just like, oh, like, I think you're mistaken. Like, oh, no, like, I'm not racist. I said I'm open-minded to dating other people.
Elle was proud to be Chinese American. She was even creating safe spaces online for other Asian American women to process the racism and misogyny they had to deal with every day. So the call-out blindsided her. Until one night, Elle was lying in bed, swiping on Tinder with her index finger.
I started to realize as I was swiping past faces, I was unconsciously, like, rejecting people because of literally, like, the color of their skin. And it shook me, made me feel bad.
There's been a lot written about how our sexual attractions are programmed by the culture. What movies we watch, what we learn about race growing up, what our families teach us. So here's my question. Once your racial preferences have been programmed by your cultural bubble, can you change them? I started calling around to sex researchers. But before I tell you what I found out, one quick note. Basically, almost all the researchers I spoke to told me there's a huge difference between something like sexual orientation and racial preference. Sexual orientation is much more biologically based, whereas racial preferences are not written into your genes. Not even if you feel a racial preference strongly.
It's kind of sad that people would just say, I just have one type, when they haven't even tried more.
Gonzalo Quintana Sunino is a neuroscientist in Canada, about to start his postdoc at the University of Toronto. He's done several studies, mostly with rats, trying to understand how people might form their partner preferences on the level of skin color or dimples. And he has an idea about why they could be hard to change. In a recent study, he conditioned rats to develop preferences for perfumed rats and found that the male rats that had all their early sexual experiences with perfumed females,
they obviously prefer the female that was bearing the scent.
But if rats had climaxed for the first time with a non-perfumed rat, even if they went on to have a lot of sex with perfumed partners, the rats did not show a preference for perfume.
Exactly.
All of which taught Sunino a crucial lesson that might even apply to people.
The first is sexual experience. The first cut was very deep.
That's because whenever you have your first sexual experience with pleasure, your brain is activating two key chemicals, dopamine and oxytocin. And together they increase pleasure and desire, arousal and bonding. And once you experience their effects, you will never forget the circumstances that made it all happen.
Whatever that is around, and whatever that your partner looks like.
And once you have an orgasm, you will pay even more attention to those cues in the future.
Absolutely.
And if you repeat the pleasure with those characteristics over and over,
well, that would just constantly reaffirm to your brain, this is what you like.
But that doesn't mean any preference is set in stone. Sunino thinks you can't subtract what's already been laid down, but you can probably add new preferences by exposing yourself to new kinds of people.
We're not prisoner of our past.
People are actually trying to think through how to do this in a systematic way, like Russell Robinson, a professor at Berkeley Law School who for the past 10 years has been teaching students about the ways in which social structures influence our romantic choices.
I don't believe in any sort of firm rules like everybody must be open to every race or everybody must stay within their race.
His position is basically, we live in a structurally racist world, so the solution isn't to shame individuals for their romantic choices. Instead, just look at your own attraction patterns and try to understand what might be shaping them.
Might you rethink that? Might you expose yourself to different types of people and try to shed the bias that has created those preferences if that's the reason behind the preferences?
Robinson doesn't even think having a racial preference is necessarily wrong. You might have very good reasons for having one. But here's what he says is key. It shouldn't be based in a racial stereotype, potentially even including stereotypes about white people. One day in class, a Latina student told Robinson she could never date a white man because a white man could never see her as fully human.
And so I told that to my dear friend who is herself Latina, and she said, you just know the universe is going to send her an amazing white man. So I like that idea that, like, you know, establishing these roles and thinking that, you know, you figured it out. It's like, then life happens.
Remember Elle from the beginning? Well, she accidentally stumbled into a version of Robinson's advice on her own. After the Tinder epiphany, she set off on a personal journey to evaluate the patterns of her own romantic attraction.
I remember thinking, like, but why do you like him so much? He's honestly, like, it's just like he's so basic.
And over the next few years, she began to notice new people on the street and on dating apps.
Sure. Oh, okay, great. He likes me. Hey.
Pausing over all kinds of people, she used to instinctually swipe away.
Then I would stop and, like, look at you. Just really give a hard look. The whole picture.
Yowei Shaw, NPR.
You can hear the rest of Elle's quest in the full Invisibilia episode on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green.
I'm Melissa Ingalls. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And join us at 3 this afternoon for more of the day's news on BBC NewsHour, followed by All Things Considered at 4 with Brady Carlson. Right now it's a minute before 9. Stay with us. News from NPR and WPR is up next.
Support for WPR comes from 54,000 members who provide the largest portion of WPR's income. They help us bring you familiar voices and new discoveries each time you tune in. Learn more about Wisconsin Public Radio at WPR.
Support comes from the Racine Symphony, presenting a Masterworks concert Saturday, May 4th at 7:30 in the Siena Center Chapel, featuring Young Artist Competition winner Noah Mercadillo and a pre-concert conversation with concertmaster Alexander Mandel. Tickets at racinesymphony.org.
.com.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.